From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis, India beginning the world's largest election, Rwanda marks 20 years since the genocide, plus universal health care proposed for older people. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Pro-Russian activists have seized state security buildings in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk and are calling for a referendum on autonomy. In response, Ukraine's parliament is demanding harsh punishment for separatists. Michael Eccles in Moscow has our report.
Holed up in a regional administrative building in Donetsk, the several hundred activists calling themselves the People's Council are demanding the right to separate from Ukraine and calling on Russian President Vladimir Putin for help. Pro-Russian demonstrators also stormed government buildings in the eastern Ukrainian cities of Lugansk and Kharkiv. Defense analyst Pavel Felgenhauer of the Novaya Gazeta newspaper said there could be a full-fledged Russian military incursion into the three eastern Ukrainian cities.
The real factor is the battle readiness of the troops that are designated there. And battle readiness seems to be right now at its highest.
However, that battle readiness can't be sustained indefinitely, Felgenhauer said, meaning that Russia has a window of opportunity to invade eastern Ukraine. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian parliament will push through anti-separatist legislation.
So, right, it's either now or never. Well, not maybe never, but at least the same level of battle readiness we have right now facing Ukraine will be maybe again reached just somewhere in August.
Felgenhauer said the current window runs from now until mid-May, at which time Russian troops deployed near Ukraine should be rotated out. This also means Ukrainian authorities in Kyiv have the same small window to take measures of their own. But what can they do? Mark Galliotti, a security expert and professor at New York University, said it is within Ukraine's abilities to use force to remove the pro-Russia activists from the buildings they have seized.
Kyiv needs to show that it has strength and determination. If it doesn't, it will embolden the protesters all the more.
Ukraine's former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko is reportedly heading to Donetsk to help defuse the situation there. According to Galliotti, in dealing with the pro-Russian protests, the Ukrainian government must perform a difficult balancing act between
being over-heavy-handed, which will just simply make things worse, but on the other hand, it can't afford to look too weak. It's a very difficult balance for Kyiv to strike.
For now, no shots have been fired. Some observers say that if Russia and Ukraine can stave off bloodshed through the May 25th presidential election and the coming summer heat, then the impending winter will keep Russian forces on their side of the border. Michael Eccles, Voice of America, Moscow, Russia.
Russia does have a large force concentrated on the border, but experts say the consequences of such a move could be severe and unpredictable. VOA's Al Pessin in London has this part of our story.
Russia withdrew one unit from its border with Ukraine last week in an apparent gesture to ease tensions. Tens of thousands of troops remain officially participating in an exercise, but it's the kind of exercise that could quickly become something else, according to the commander of NATO's sizable military force, American General Philip Breedlove.
The force that is at the Ukrainian border now to the east is very, very sizable and very, very ready.
And it's facing a much smaller Ukrainian force, including many reservists and new volunteers. NATO forces are relatively far away, like these in Germany, and officials have made clear they do not want to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. It seems that eastern Ukraine, with its large ethnic Russian population, is there for the taking if Russian leaders decide they want it. But it's a large area and difficult to defend. Russia expert Igor Sutyagin of London's Royal United Services Institute does not think an invasion is imminent.
To secure that in tight manner, you need such enormous amount of troops. So it's possible to invade, it's possible to seize some parts of Ukraine, but it's probably impossible to keep them.
At the International Institute for Strategic Studies, retired British Brigadier Ben Barry says Russia could also face other challenges in eastern Ukraine, where the percentage of ethnic Russians is much lower than in Crimea.
there would be the prospect of some sort of long-term Ukrainian people's war, guerrilla movement, terrorism, something that would militarily oppose the occupation by the Russian forces on the long term.
In addition, the international community would likely increase the economic and diplomatic isolation imposed on Russia because of the Crimea takeover. International moves so far have been criticized as weak, but Igor Sutyagin says they're already costing Russia tens of billions of dollars and serve as a significant deterrent to further adventurism.
Economic measures being undertaken by NATO members are much more serious than any sanctions or, military moves.
Experts also say Russia could achieve many of its apparent goals for Ukraine without invading again, including the weakening of the Kyiv government's influence in the east, making the region economically dependent on Russia, and sending a message to NATO not to even consider putting troops on its border. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
And here in Washington on Monday, the White House cautioned Russia against military intervention in eastern Ukraine. White House spokesperson Jay Carney.
We're concerned about several escalatory moves in Ukraine over the weekend, and we see those as a result of increased Russian pressure on Ukraine. As you noted, we saw groups of pro-Russian demonstrators take over government buildings in the eastern cities of Kharkiv, Donetsk, and Luhansk. And there is strong evidence suggesting some of these demonstrators were paid and were not local residents.
Carney further cautioned the Kremlin regarding eastern Ukraine.
If Russia moves into eastern Ukraine, either overtly or covertly, this would be a very serious escalation. We call on President Putin and his government to cease all efforts to destabilize Ukraine. And we caution against further military intervention.
White House spokesperson also added that if the U.S. is ready to impose further sanctions against Russia, should the situation escalate any further. Also in Washington and at the State Department, a spokesperson Jennifer Psaki said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry had spoken again with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Monday.
Made clear that any further Russian efforts to destabilize Ukraine will incur further costs for Russia. And the ministers also discussed convening direct talks within the next 10 days between Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and the EU to try to de-escalate the tensions.
Psaki also noted that the Secretary of State spoke about ways of getting beyond the current crisis.
He conveyed to Foreign Minister Lavrov that the United States is watching events over the last 24 hours in Kharkiv, Donetsk, Luhansk, and Mariupol with great concern, and noted that these do not appear to be a spontaneous set of events. Rather, the Secretary noted the Ukrainian government's assertion that this appeared to be a carefully orchestrated campaign with Russian support.
State Department spokesperson also said Mr. Kerry agreed to meet with top diplomats from Russia, Ukraine, and the European Union in a new push to calm tensions in eastern Ukraine. Meeting is set to take place in the next 10 days.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
In India, more than 800 million registered voters are casting ballots for seats in the 543-seat lower house of parliament. Voting in the world's largest democracy is spread out in 9 stages over 5 weeks. Kanti Prasad Bajpai of the National University of Singapore tells VOA's Victor Beatty he's hopeful the election will be free and fair and nonviolent. He's also looking closely for signs of a strong voter turnout.
Early indications are from voter surveys and so on that as many as 70% of the electorate might come out and vote, and that would be a very, very high figure given the last 20, 25 years of elections. So I think voter participation is a second big hope, and I think we're going to see it. And thirdly, I think everyone's looking forward to a fairly clear result so that the country can get back to business as quickly as possible with no uncertainties about who's going to govern. And there's a big economic and social agenda ahead of of the country. And so the election is important for putting in place stable governments.
If he wins, would Mr. Modi be a divisive figure?
For some people, he will be a divisive figure. Some Hindus who are more secular-minded certainly worry about him. There are people amongst some sections of the lower castes who are not very attracted to him, who see him as being more oriented towards the upper castes. Of course, minority voters, particularly Muslims in India, who are 12% of the electorate and concentrated in key northern states, they will worry about Mr. Modi as well.
There's going to be a big youth vote this time around. What do young people in India want?
You're right. I mean, 100 million new voters are coming into the election. So that means these are people between the ages of 18 and about 23 or 24. They're quite attuned to Modi, but also to other protest parties and movements against corruption and the downturn in the economy. So, of course, those are the two big things that young people will be looking for. Clean government, effective government, and, of course, on the other side, good economic management and the restoration of economic growth, which means, of course, jobs. Young Indians want jobs and good-paying jobs and interesting jobs. So I think corruption, but even more than that, economic growth and employment opportunities, that's what they'll be looking for.
Aside from the economy, what are the pressing domestic and foreign policy issues the new administration will have to grapple with?
There's always the question of managing the kind of ramshackle bureaucracy that's everywhere in India. So I think people want decisive and effective governance on the ground in areas that they deal with every day. There's also a great desire for investments in things like infrastructure, public health, in better education. And then, of course, on the internal security front, people want some breakthroughs in dealing with the Maoists in central India. They want a general sense of law and order. And on the foreign policy and international security front, I think most people would look for this government to continue the Manmohan Singh's government's record of stability with major regional partners and rivals, the smaller countries to be sure, but especially Pakistan and China. I think there the Manmohan Singh government has a pretty good record, and I don't think anyone's looking for anything very different. With the United States, I think in general the mood will be to try and bring the relationship back on the rails after a series of difficulties. And of course there'll be some curiosity about how the United States and India get past the Modi problem. That is the issue of whether the United States will get down to business with Modi, given that the Americans have not given Modi a visa for the last 10 or 15 years.
Kanti Prasad Vajpayee of National University of Singapore. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. A month ago today, Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 with 239 people aboard went missing on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Since then, search crews have combed huge portions of the oceans, mainly the southern Indian Ocean, looking for any signs of where that plane might have crashed. In recent days, Chinese and Australian ships have picked up pings, which might be from the plane's flight data recorders. While that search continues, Chinese relatives of Flight 370's passengers gathered today in Beijing for a prayer vigil.
已经一个月了，那我觉得说这一个月大家经历了很多的痛苦也好，悲伤也好。
Steve Wong, one of the organizers of the vigil, said that despite the recent sadness, the affected families must somehow pull through. A candlelight vigil was held in Kuala Lumpur on Monday, marking the first month since Flight 370 went missing. Some of the candles were laid out to spell MH370, while others formed the outline of a plane. Peter Chong was among those attending the vigil.
We prayed for the families to have strength, and courage to be able to accept whatever eventuality there may be.
Family members have said that their greatest hope at this moment is to find the plane, which the Malaysian government announced late last month probably crashed in the southern Indian Ocean, killing everyone on board. Malaysian authorities have faced heavy criticism, particularly from China, for mismanaging the search and holding back information. Most of the 227 passengers were Chinese.
Start your days with VOA's Daybreak Asia.
Daybreak Asia.
While Asia slept the night before, we've been hard at work gathering the news and talking with the newsmakers so you'll have the news you need to know for the day ahead. Pushing yesterday's stories forward and getting Washington's take on what's going on across the region, the Daybreak Asia team brings you the unique, where other media are merely repeating what you already know. Get a fresh perspective to begin your day, starting at 22 hours Universal Time, Monday through Friday, here on The Voice of America.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame paid tribute to the victims of the 1994 Rwandan genocide on Monday and praised the country's rapid rebuilding over the past 20 years. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the president also took a swipe at the international community following a diplomatic riff with France.
African heads of state and foreign dignitaries joined commemoration events in the Rwandan capital, beginning with a ceremony to light the national flame of mourning at the Kigali Genocide Memorial. April 7th marks the day 20 years ago when ethnic Hutu militias began a killing rampage, targeting Tutsis and moderate Hutus who would not take part in the slaughter. Some 800,000 people were killed within 100 days. President Kagame honored the victims at a memorial event at Kigali's Amahoro Stadium.
As we pay tribute to the victims, both the living and those who have passed, we also salute the unbreakable Rwandan spirit to which we owe the survival and renewal of our country.
Thousands of people filled stadium seats to watch speeches, performances, and a video to commemorate the anniversary. Shouts and wails could be heard throughout the crowd as some became overwhelmed with emotion. Handlers dispersed in the stands helped soothe those who had become distraught. Current and former leaders from around the world also turned out for the occasion, but France withdrew its delegation in protest over comments from President Kagame, accusing France of having a role in the planning and execution of the genocide. France has long denied the claims. France was the Rwandan government's main Western backer before the genocide and trained its Hutu-dominated army. While not directly mentioning the dispute, Mr. Kagame said Rwandans will continue to seek concrete explanations for the genocide.
People cannot be bribed or forced into changing their history. And no country is powerful enough, even when they think they are, to change the facts.
The international community has been criticized for not doing enough to prevent the genocide, despite numerous warnings. Speaking at the memorial event, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon acknowledged these shortcomings.
Many United Nations personnel and others showed remarkable bravery, but we could have done much more. We should have done much more.
Mr. Bond said the international community still has more to learn from the lessons of Rwanda, noting the failure to stop the conflicts in Central African Republic and in Syria. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kigali.
The murder trial of South African runner Oscar Pistorius resumed on Monday with defense lawyers launching their case. Pistorius took the stand in a dramatic highlight of his already intense trial. VOA's Anita Powell was in the courtroom in Pretoria.
Before Oscar Pistorius began to testify in his own defense on Monday, he told Judge Thokozile Masipa he had something he'd like to say.
I'd like to apologize and say that there's not a moment, and there hasn't been a moment since this tragedy happened that I haven't thought about your family.
Mr. and Mrs. Steenkamp are the parents of model Reva Steenkamp, Pistorius's girlfriend of 3 months. The athlete is charged with murdering her at his Pretoria home in February 2013. He says he mistook her for an intruder when he shot 4 times through a locked bathroom door. Anita Powell of Pretoria, South Africa.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Monday was World Health Day, and one non-governmental organization used the occasion to warn that 76 million older people around the world are being excluded from vital health care. I report from VOA's Joe DiCapua.
HelpAge International is trying to raise awareness through its Age Demands Action campaign. Amlaset Tewodros is the group's country director for Tanzania.
Age Demands Action is a campaign that empowers older people to directly engage with their leaders, in this particular case with the Ministry of Health officials, to demand the access to services, to health services, to be appropriate, age-friendly, accessible to older people. So it gives older people an opportunity to present their demands and their requests to the relevant policy and decision makers.
She says millions of older people around the world are not getting the care they need for diseases and chronic conditions.
There are a number of non-communicable diseases that are showing steady growth among older population groups, for example, diabetes, high blood pressure, arthritis, prostate cancer, and respiratory diseases.
Amlaset says the current emphasis in healthcare is on communicable and childhood diseases. She says healthcare programs usually do not have a lifelong, healthy aging approach. Lack of respect and discrimination can also be barriers to adequate healthcare for older people.
Old age is associated with diseases, so older people are not treated for the illnesses they present, but rather they're looked at, oh, you are old and resources are limited. Those should be directed to young people, to children. So these are some of the constraints that are limiting older people's access.
In many developing countries, Amlaset says the emphasis is on building infrastructure and hospital admissions, which can be expensive. As a result, she says, less attention is paid to health promotion and prevention, especially for age-related diseases and conditions. What's more, many healthcare workers may not be adequately trained to help older patients. The HelpAge International official says universal healthcare would help solve many of these problems.
Universal healthcare would help in the sense that it will provide equity in terms of access to healthcare for all population groups. If healthcare has to be paid for, a lot of these people who lack funds to pay for consultation, who lack funds for transport, who lack funds for paying for the cost of drugs are constrained by their inability to benefit or to access basic healthcare, which is fundamental for their survival.
Amlaset says political will can overcome concerns about cost.
We have experiences in a number of countries where we have seen positive progress, which did not require a huge investment. It is an issue of commitment and policy adjustments, making sure health policymakers, programmers do take into account the specific needs, the unique needs of all the population groups, and provide appropriate, affordable, and accessible health care. That is the message.
HelpAge International also warns the life expectancy in nearly 40 countries is either remaining static at 60 or has fallen. It says community health care is vital to ensure older people maintain a good quality of life. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
World Health Organization on Monday highlighted World Health Day with information about the increasing threat of vector-borne diseases. More than half of the world's population is at risk from diseases such as malaria, dengue fever, Lyme disease, yellow fever, and more, all of them carried by mosquitoes, flies, ticks, water snails, and other vectors. Vector-borne diseases affect the poorest populations, particularly where there is a lack of adequate housing or safe drinking water and sanitation. Malnourished people and those with weakened immunity are especially susceptible. More than 1 billion people are infected, and more than 1 million people die from vector-borne diseases every year. WHO says the diseases are entirely preventable, and a new published brief on vector-borne diseases outlines steps that governments, community groups, and families can take to protect people from infection. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here today for International Edition on the Voice of America. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers Marty Curcius and Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. April 8th is the day celebrated by many Buddhists as the birthday of Gautama Buddha, the founder of their religion. Tradition holds that Buddha was born as Siddhartha Gautama more than 2,500 years ago in what is present-day Nepal. In 1730, Sherith Israel, the first Jewish synagogue in America, was dedicated in New York City. On this day in 1935, the U.S. Congress passed the Emergency Relief Appropriations Act, granting President Franklin D. Roosevelt's request for nearly $5 billion to fund the Works Progress Administration, the largest relief program in American history. The program was created to relieve the suffering of millions due to the effects of the Great Depression. In 1945, noted anti-Nazi pastor and theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer was condemned to death by a judge in Germany shortly before the end of World War II. Bonhoeffer, who was part of a conspiracy against Adolf Hitler, was hanged the next day. On this day in 1953, the leader of the Kenyan independence movement, Jomo Kenyatta, was convicted of involvement in extremist violence against white settlers and sentenced to 7 years in prison at hard labor. In 1963, Kenya won its independence, and in 64, Kenyatta was elected president. On the evening of April 8, 1974, Hank Aaron broke one of baseball's most coveted records, hitting his 715th home run. He thus broke the 39-year-old record set by baseball great Babe Ruth. In 2013, Britain's first female prime minister, Margaret Thatcher, died of a stroke. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Human Rights Council sent a clear message on March 28th that North Korea's leadership must be held to account for its systematic and widespread human rights violations. The United States and the international community stand with the North Korean people. The resolution adopted was based on the findings and recommendations of the UN Commission of Inquiry, whose work was strongly supported by the United States. The Commission of Inquiry on North Korea found that crimes against humanity have been committed for decades under policies established at the highest levels of the North Korean government. The past and ongoing crimes committed in North Korea include extermination, murder, enslavement, torture and imprisonment, rape, forced abortion and other sexual violence, persecution on political, religious, racial and gender grounds, the forcible transfer of populations, enforced disappearances, and knowingly caused prolonged starvation. The resolution was adopted by 30 votes in favor, 6 against, and 11 abstentions. The resolution condemned the violations in North Korea in the strongest terms, renewed the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in North Korea, and called on the UN to establish a field-based structure to continue monitoring and documenting human rights abuses occurring in North Korea. The United States is committed to working closely with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to support the Special Rapporteur and to set up the field office to continue the work of the Commission of Inquiry. There must be no let-up in international pressure for justice in North Korea. This Human Rights Council resolution assures that those suffering in North Korea are not forgotten.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.